Welcome back, clinical problem solvers. Maddie and Yusuf here. At CP Solvers, our mission is to make clinical reasoning accessible to learners worldwide. We invite you to join us for our live virtual morning reports, where we break down cases and sharpen our diagnostic reasoning together. Now over to you, Yusuf.
Thanks, Maddie. Just a quick reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only and is not a substitute for medical advice. Patient details have been modified to protect their privacy, and the views expressed here are our own, not those of our employers. Now, let's dive into the case.
Enjoy the show!
Okay, welcome, Clinical Problem Solvers. Thanks for joining us in the holiday week. I know you guys are supposed to be either busy with working or spending time with family. So thanks to everyone who's joining with us. Today, we have a really special guest, Greg, who is going to be presenting a case to us. So I'm going to let Greg, you know, for those of you who don't know him, introduce himself.
Hi, y'all. My name is Greg Kirshen. I am a current second year maternal fetal medicine fellow in Philadelphia. My clinical interests include diagnostic reasoning, pregnancy physiology, pharmacology, and pregnancy. This is not going to be a pregnancy related case, but I thought it was a very interesting case. So very excited to be presenting it to Jeffrey.
Yeah, amazing. And then I believe we have Siva who's scribing. Siva, do you want to introduce yourself? How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing good. I'm Siva. I'm originally from India, currently based in Buffalo. Excited for the case today.
Awesome. And I think Julia's doing teaching points. How are you doing, Julia?
Hello, everyone. I'm Julia. I'm at Cobra Dutch from Brazil, actually, in Arizona. And yeah, I'm doing great. Excited for Greg's case.
Awesome. All right. Well, why don't we get started, Greg?
All right, let's do it. So ALK1 just can be the chief complaint. So this is a 30-year-old male who originally presents to your clinic with a constellation of several symptoms. He has had lower abdominal pain, pelvic pain, perianal numbness and tingling, as well as aches and pains in both his upper and lower extremities bilaterally, especially in his fingers, that have been going on for actually several years, months to years duration.
Okay, awesome.
I'll stop there.
So yeah, I'll start with this really interesting chief complaint. So I guess being a rheumatologist, we often see patients for complaints of chronic pain, chronic fatigue. And it seems like this, we're dealing with a young man who is coming in with a lot of different complaints, but one of the main complaints there is diffuse pain. As we will see with neurology, one of the big aspects of pain that is taught classically in neurology is how to localize where this is. So I think that's going to be one of the important things that we'll try to have to do as we go through the history and as we go through the exam. And keeping in mind that in rheumatology, because diseases are chronic and we often see patients after a chronic history, that there can be actually multiple different complaints at the same time. So multiple different localizations, or you can even have one localization and have multiple different contributing factors to it. So we will need to keep that in mind. Kind of just starting in the beginning thoughts of what kind of things that I would be interesting to know in the history. So most people who have pain and aches in many different areas of the body don't also have a symptom of numbness or tingling. When you have numbness or tingling, that is a little bit of a suggestion that partially some of this may be due to nerve involvement. Now, this is a little bit complicated because, you know, nerve involvement doesn't mean that this necessarily has to be a primary neurological process. For example, you can have lumbar spinal stenosis, and that's more of a degenerative or orthopedic process and secondary nerve involvement. So right now I'm trying to figure out, is this a primary neurological process or is this a secondary neurological process? The other thing I'll point out is this complaint of perianal numbness is quite specific, unique, and it's not something that people typically complain of when they just have a pain. So what could be the cause of this? I think that will be another thing that we will want to key in. When did that specific symptom start? All right, Greg.
All right. Thanks so much, Jeffrey. Very rich discussion already. I'm about to hit you with a lot of information here on this history of present illness. So he had been in his usual state of health until he actually had back-to-back, only mildly symptomatic COVID-19 infections. This was about 3 years ago, at which time he was noted to have high COVID-19 antibody titers. Just a couple weeks after resolution of the infections, he noted pain in his buttocks, anus, penis, and scrotum, as well as his right lower quadrant. He reported some dysuria, but no hematuria, some urinary hesitancy with some midstream involuntary urethral sphincter contraction, no incontinence. This was associated with some perianal tingling, but no loss of bowel function. And he is also able to empty his bladder. On review of systems, he also reports that around this time, he has been experiencing aches in his fingers, especially with stretching, myalgias in his arms and legs, and some tingling in his feet. The pain in his buttock has limited his ability to sit for long periods of time. He reports periodic dysesthesias and paresthesias in his upper and lower extremities, as well as some shooting pains in his feet, which he was told was consistent with plantar fasciitis. He interestingly also has had kind of waxing and waning redness in his right foot, denies any Raynaud phenomenon. At the time of his initial evaluation, he was recommended to see a physical therapist for pelvic floor dysfunction and was prescribed pregabalin, gabapentin, and ibuprofen for suspected neuropathic pain, as well as pelvic floor Botox injections. His pain and his paresthesias have now persisted for several years, waxing and waning in severity. Also of note, a few months after his initial evaluation, he had a protracted episode of pain in his right elbow after just a minor fall, limiting his ability to play sports, throw a ball, or carry groceries. He was diagnosed with tennis elbow and has been working with a physical therapist, although he feels that his pain is really only about 25% improved. In the intervening months, he's also experienced protracted pain in his left elbow and the ulnar aspect of his hand after a minor fall on the left arm. He now has to take steps slowly when climbing stairs. He was of note very previously athletic, playing baseball, running, and lifting weights without any functional limitations. Now he says if he were to grip an object with strong force, he feels like sort of like a shooting nerve pain in his fingers and palms that last a few days. As far as his medical history is concerned, he has a history of GERD. We talked about pelvic floor dysfunction, insomnia, seborrheic dermatitis that affects his scalp and his beard. And he also, which I'll get to a little further on, has had some MRIs showing tendinopathy in the large joints, and he does carry a working diagnosis of psoriatic arthritis. In terms of his medications, he is taking gabapentin, pregabalin, ibuprofen, the Botox injections. He has PRN diazepam for insomnia, and he also takes doxycycline and trazodone for the insomnia. He has no known allergies. His past surgical history, he had a right inguinal hernia repair with mesh as a child. For his family history, his mother has a history of mesothelioma. He does have type 1 diabetes in his maternal aunt. He has a cousin with hypothyroidism, and he has two cousins with celiac disease. Finally, in terms of his social history, he has a remote history of chlamydia treated in 2017, otherwise unremarkable. And I'll stop there.
Wow, such a rich history, aliquot over here that we have. So, definitely a lot of things that we're going to try to have to see whether they tie together or are these different things that are happening at the same time, given that it's a chronic disease that we're kind of looking for, or chronic conditions that we're looking for. That's one of the most important things to try, be able to try to figure out. So, a lot of times when a rheumatologist has to evaluate a patient, what we're looking for, what we're being asked to do is to identify a pattern. And one of the most important things that can confuse a pattern is that something that can be a sequence of events can coincidentally look like a pattern. So that's one of the things that I'm trying to keep in mind. You know, for example, this all started after COVID. Is this something that we need to take into account and is part of the pattern? Or is this just a sequence of events where he happened to have COVID and then the symptoms developed afterwards? So that's something that we'll keep into consideration. Now, I guess I will focus again on like what jumps out to me specifically, because we have a lot of complaints that can we say be nonspecific. And what nonspecific really means is there's a wide variety of etiologies that can cause it. So I think still at this point, the thing that I want to understand the best is the pelvic symptoms, the pelvic anal symptoms, where he's noticing issues with pain there, but also tingling. So the question that I'm going to try to understand there is, what type of pathology are we really dealing with there? And when I think of pathologies that involve numbness or tingling there and pain, the first thing that jumps to my mind is going to be looking at the spine. Now, if this was an acute presentation, right, and you had someone who came acutely to you with an acute onset of back pain, especially with urinary and pelvic numbness, tingling complaints, and problems with either retention or other issues like incontinence, one thing you would be worried about is some type of spinal cord compression syndrome or catecholamine. But given this is so chronic, I would be thinking about a different type of etiology, something a little bit more chronic. So one thing I would be curious as to look at is, does the distribution of his numbness or tingling on the exam correlate with the spinal cord pathology? And then you can ask, why would somebody who's young have a spinal cord issue? Why would that be happening, right? And so typically in my experience, when this happens, we can ask, is this patient, that we're dealing with a weightlifter? And I've seen so far that, several times that people who lift weights that are very active, they can have small disc herniations. And that can sometimes cause issues with radiculopathy, can cause issues in the pelvic area. So that's one thing that I'm going to try to figure out is, does this pain different in different areas with the numbness and tingling really localized to the spinal cord or not? And one thing that can be helpful with that on a neurological exam is going to be the reflexes. And then what should we do with the other symptoms that we're dealing with? So, in addition, he's not just noticing that there is changes in sensation and pain there, but he's also noticing that there's issues with things like dysuria, hematuria, and changes to his urination. So the question there is, are we dealing with a primary pathology that's in the GU tract, or are we dealing with something secondary, right? So I think that's another part. If we are doing a thorough evaluation of the spine, of the neurological issues, and we don't notice that there's a neurological cause for these GU complaints, right? Because you can have, for example, UTIs, secondary things, prostatitis, and that can be secondary to having issues with the neurological sensation there. But if we don't have evidence for that, then we will have to look primarily, is there a problem in the GU tract itself? Or is there a problem in the surrounding anatomy there? And then after that, what should we do with these arthralgias, these changes in color that we're dealing with in multiple different areas? And also documented exam findings previously with plantar fasciitis, erythema of the foot, and even epicondylitis or maybe tendonitis of the elbow. So what we're dealing with here is we're dealing with inflammatory arthritis, but not necessarily of the actual joint, but around the joint. So in rheumatology, we term this inflammatory periarthritis. And what's going to be really important to tease out here is there also true inflammatory arthritis, or is it just mostly periarthritis around the joint? And why is that important? Because inflammation around the joint can have many different etiologies, the most common of which is going to be working out too much, overuse, right? So if you think about the last time maybe that you injured your shoulder and it feels like it's hurt and it's swollen or red, right? It's because that you have what we think of as mechanical or traumatic overuse, and that causes bursitis, and that can be inflammatory. But that will be around the joint and not actually inside the joint. Furthermore, just because if the joint inflammation is kind of not indirectly in the joint but around it, doesn't mean that it's not a rheumatologic disease either, right? So any actual problems with the joints, the muscles, the nerves can make it harder for someone to do what's normal, right? So for example, let's say you have somebody with neuropathy in both of their legs. It's going to be easier for them to fall. It's going to be easier for them to injure themselves. With those injuries, you can have complications like bursitis or periarthritis. So that's another thing that we're going to have to tease out. The distribution of these locations, if they were to be a rheumatologic cause, correlate a lot better with a spondyloarthropathy than with pure rheumatoid arthritis. Even though rheumatoid arthritis can occasionally have issues like bursitis or periarthritis, it's much, much more likely or classic for it to have true inflammatory arthritis. And those complaints are not something that we're seeing technically here. With the involvement of plantar fasciitis, one of the things that will come to mind is to differentiate whether this tendonitis is truly just tendonitis or is it enthesitis, which means that there's specific tenderness at the points of insertion. If you have enthesitis, again, mechanical issues can still cause that, but that's where the question of seronegative spondyloarthropathies rise. And then if we look at the seborrheic dermatitis, there's two ways to analyze that. One is it's just seborrheic dermatitis, which can be common, right? And it can cause things like dandruff. Dandruff by itself in seborrheic dermatitis is common, or One other possibility is that it looks like seborrheic dermatitis, but it may be a different rash. And the classic rash that looks like that would be psoriasis, right? So I can understand why, if this patient was evaluated by a rheumatologist, putting these together, they would think, is it possible that this patient has psoriatic arthritis? Now, one thing that can be missed sometimes in people that are not specifically looking for it is the fingernails. So, in people with psoriatic arthritis, they have a much higher incidence of fingernail problems than people with just psoriasis and osteoarthritis, two different things, right? It's not 100% going to guarantee that they have psoriatic arthritis. It's not perfectly sensitive or specific, but it can be a huge hint. So, what I'd be asking for or looking for is, are there changes in the nails? Do they crack on their own? Things like that. And I'm excited to see what the exam shows.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeffrey. This is a master class. I think similar to you, when I've thought about this case, it's so hard to sift through all the data, figure out, is this an Occam's razor or a Hickam's dictum kind of thing? And I think you've done a beautiful job so far of dissecting it. So I'll give you the physical exam, and I also have some images to share with you. So on exam, his vital signs were all within normal limits. He was afebrile. He's in no acute distress. In terms of his head and neck exam, he had clear conjunctiva and no scalp tenderness. Let me just share my screen real quick and I'll show you a couple of pictures. Okay, so this was his ear area. You can see a little bit of a rash, maybe a little bit of redness, flakiness. And then his heart and lung exams were within normal limits. I'll just quickly show you. This was one of the episodes where his right foot had that erythema. It was non-tender to palpation, however. And then, as far as the rest of his exam, his abdomen was soft, non-tender, non-distended. His skin, he had no digital ulcerations, no pallor, no cyanosis, no erythema, no plaque or nail pitting. He had full range of motion in his neck, full range of motion in his shoulders. In his arm exam, he had intact sensation to light touch in the radial, median, and ulnar nerve distributions. Provocative testing for a trigger finger was negative. There was no tenderness to palpation at the base joint of the MP joint or the IP joints of the thumb on either side, no triggering. They did note some thickening of the flexor tendons, middle and right at the A1 pulley bilaterally, left greatest at the middle finger without triggering again with provocative maneuvers with minimal tenderness. There was no, excuse me, no tenderness over the lateral epicondyles on either side. No pain with resisted wrist or middle finger extension while the elbows were maximally extended. Normal back alignment without tenderness to palpation. He had full range of motion in the hips without groin pain. No tenderness in the knees or no swelling. No, and then his feet, as I mentioned, were non-tender to palpation as well. And I think the last thing is just his neurological exam. So he was ANO times four, attentive, normal concentration, fluent speech, normal cranial nerves. He had normal bulk tone, no fasciculations, negative pronator drift. Formal power testing showed full strength in all muscle groups. Sensation, he had slightly reduced pinprick bilaterally in the mid shin. Temperature, vibration, and proprioception were all intact in all dermatomes. He had 2+ biceps brachioradialis, triceps patellar, and Achilles tendon reflexes without clonus. Hoffman's or crossed adductor sign response was negative. Plantar responses were flexor bilaterally. For his coordination, he had no tremor, negative Romberg. And then for his gait, was standard with normal stride, arm swing, and turning, and heel to toe, walking, and tandem gait were normal. I'll stop there.
Okay, awesome. Wow. What an extensive physical exam and very comprehensive. So I guess I'll just start by, going back to what I was most concerned about, which is what is causing these odd symptoms that he's having kind of in the pelvic area. And are those odd symptoms neurologic, or are they primarily non-neurologic with a secondary neurologic kind of issue? So I think what we're seeing here with the neurological exam is that there's not really much in the lower extremities that's showing that there's a neurological issue essentially. And that can be tricky sometimes, as sometimes that you can have actual that still you can have radiculopathy that's intermittent or it's very mild. But because we're not having a lot of signal there, it makes me think that it may be more likely that it's a secondary issue. So then, what do we do about the other kind of symptoms that we saw? So, One of the symptoms or one of the areas that we were looking at is the rash. And I'll say just, of course, I'm not a dermatologist, but taking a look at the rash to see whether this is psoriasis or seborrheic dermatitis, what would make me think or heavily favor psoriasis in the circumstance would be if it was very scaly. And so the rash that we're seeing right now, it's a little bit erythematous, it's a little bit scaly. Hard to really say that it's more than just seborrheic dermatitis and actually does go into psoriasis area. I think if it was much more extensive or that there's other locations involved, it would help us understand more. And sometimes a dermatologist can take a look and look at the scalp to see if, which one of those two are more likely. And that being said, you can have seronegative spondyloarthropathies even without psoriasis. So, for example, a patient can have ankylosing spondylitis or inflammatory bowel disease, and you don't need the psoriasis lesions to have arthritis from those. One other thing to think about, especially in the context of a preceding infection, is could this be reactive arthritis, right? Usually, when we have patients that have reactive arthritis, in the original description, we learn this kind of phenomenon where we say, can't see, can't pee, climb a tree, right? So the triad there is you have GI or GU infection causing the urinary abnormalities. The can't see part is usually due to eye inflammation, which often is either conjunctivitis or can even be uveitis or keratitis. And then third, the can't climb a tree is due to the arthritis. And the arthritis is actually usually in a periarthritis plus an inflammatory arthritis. Now, given that an infection such as COVID was occurring before this, definitely reactive arthritis is something to think about. Most cases of reactive arthritis do go away eventually over time. However, it's thought that up to maybe one third or one fourth of cases can be persistent. So that's one thing that we should also keep in our mind. Is there something that activated that? And COVID can cause reactive arthritis, but it would be a little bit unusual for COVID to be causing the GU symptoms because we don't really typically think of COVID causing things like UTI or prostatitis. So one of the questions is, could it be that when he came in with COVID, he also had either a UTI, prostatitis, or some type of infection in the pelvic area as well? And that infection was actually the primary driver of the reactive arthritis. There's not many infections in that area that can produce a long-standing history of reactive arthritis, but some of them that can be missed and are a little bit kind of subacute to chronic would be mycoplasma or ureaplasma. And both these infections are atypical infections. They would be negative on blood cultures and can cause pulmonary symptoms that would look or respiratory viral symptoms that would look like COVID. So it's something that we can think about. In addition, what are we going to do with these findings of the unilateral leg changes of where we're not having pain, but we're having changes in the color? And we can take a look at that foot and we can say that this is not Raynaud's. And because it's not painful, this is probably not complex regional pain syndrome. So what could be the cause for unilateral changes there? So I'm definitely not an expert in the different type of neurological issues that can cause skin changes there. And I won't comment necessarily on the skin part of the issues. But when I've seen this in my experience, there are a couple of things that can cause this discoloration. Probably the most common thing that I see that causes this discoloration is just severe inflammatory arthritis previously. So I presented a case internally before of a person who came for intermittent or even permanent discoloration of his vessels, and that would occur from time to time. And that patient had really bad gout, and the gout flare can cause so much inflammation. It causes hyperemia, which is essentially when the blood vessels get engorged, and that can lead to discoloration almost even permanently through hyperpigmentation there. So one possible question is, did he have severe inflammation of that entire foot area, or especially like around the ankle? What else could that be? The other thing that's really important to make sure that we're not missing is, could this be vascular disease, right? So we didn't get many symptoms of when he's walking, does the foot hurt more then, right? That would be one question to ask to if you're thinking about peripheral arterial disease. Now we'll say we were dealing with a younger man, so it'd be unusual to have peripheral arterial disease. But we also have a patient that has had a lot of symptoms after COVID. So we know that COVID can rarely cause problems in the blood flow. And we hear this blue toe syndrome. So a similar thought is, could he have had a vascular component of attack from the COVID that's leading to the changes there, right? So I'm thinking of Secondary to inflammatory arthritis, I'm thinking of could this be vascular, arterial, which is usually a little bit more dangerous than venous, but both of them can cause it. And then lastly, again, back to the neurogenic claudication or neurogenic issues can also cause changes in the foot, right? We talked about complex regional pain syndrome, which is unlikely because there's no pain. It's usually very severe pain. But again, it makes me wonder, could he have some type of compression intermittently in one of the nerves that goes down to the foot there? And the area that's affected, the dorsum and the bottom of the foot, would be consistent with L5-S1. So if we haven't had imaging in the back, that's something that we can think of as well. If it's not in the back, you can also have kind of focal compression in different areas. Something that's common and it's easy to misdiagnose that looks like sciatica, for example, is piriformis syndrome. Those can, and that would also make sense of why it would be unilateral. So that those are the kind of things I'm thinking in terms of the color changes. And then finally, we're not getting any on the exam, we're not getting any signs of inflammatory arthritis. And we're specifically not even getting many signs of periarthritis, but we do have signs that there has been chronic inflammation there. So what do we do with those results in terms of a rheumatologic disease? So again, if we really think about the primary inflammatory arthritis that is chronic, so in rheumatology, there are three big buckets of primary inflammatory arthritis. And what I mean by primary is that there is no systemic involvement because any rheumatologic condition can cause inflammatory arthritis, right? Lupus can cause inflammatory arthritis, but we think of it as a secondary involvement. You have a systemic disease and you have secondary arthritis. But there's really only three big groups that almost only show up as arthritis. And number one is going to be rheumatoid arthritis. Number two is going to be the seronegative spondyloarthropathies. And number three is going to be crystalline arthropathies. Now, out of these three, if we take a picture and we look at which one of these is most likely to cause arthritis that comes and goes and flares and is completely normal in between, the most common one to cause that is crystalline arthropathies. However, the important thing that we have to know about that is usually crystalline arthropathies, things like gout, pseudogout, are very painful when they come in the flare. They require treatment, often needing to go to the ER or urgent care. And then after a couple of days after treatment, the patient is feeling totally normal. Over here, we're not getting necessarily that story. We're getting a story of where we have some a chronic type of pain. So it's almost like there's an underlying chronic issue with flares. Now, not saying that it can't be gout or pseudogout, but because of that, it makes it a little bit more likely as well to consider seronegative spondyloarthropathies. And why is it important to consider that? Is because the flares, again, in seronegative spondyloarthropathies, there's multiple different types. One type of flare is the type that causes tendonitis, bursitis, or enthesitis. Again, this is periarthritis. These always come and go. They can eventually become chronic. And one of the important things to know is that when in rheumatology, we talk about inflammatory arthritis, right? And we talk about it gets better with movement, it gets better with activity. For seronegative spondyloarthropathy, it often gets worse with activity. It's triggered by activity. So that's why I think it's important not to just, memorize like that if it's an inflammatory, it will necessarily improve with activity. But in the psoriatic arthritis realm, it's often very complicated because you have multiple different types of arthritis that we're dealing with. So I think what we would be dealing with here is what I would say is a milder version. And what I mean by mild is just that we don't have chronic inflammatory arthritis that we're dealing with on exam. But a milder version possibly of a seronegative spondyloarthropathy. And I would want to get x-rays of the affected joints, possibly ultrasound to see if there's inflammation as well in the synovium, then HLA-B27, and then uric acid. And if he has actually effusions, it would be important to get an arthrocentesis to look for crystals.
Excellent discussion, Jeffrey. This is just amazing. This is a really complex case, and I feel like you're distilling it very logically. And as you mentioned, so in his case, his pain is certainly triggered by activity. So maybe that's a key differentiating factor. Because I'm certainly no rheumatologist, but I remember in medical school we learn, rheumatoid arthritis, they wake up with joint pain, tends to get better throughout the day. Versus, other types of arthritis may get worse with activity. So I think that's also a important point that you made. You requested some imaging and some labs, so I'm going to give you some of that information now. So he was evaluated by orthopedics, neurology, and rheumatology. I'll give you his imaging first, and then I'll go through some of his labs. So he had an MRI spine that showed a small T2 hyperintensity within the central aspect of the spinal cord at C6, C7, measuring 1 millimeter in diameter, compatible with just prominence of the central canal. Otherwise, there was no evidence of cauda equina. He had a multiplanar T2 MRI of the pelvis, which showed that he had a hernia repair, possibly tiny recurrent fat containing a right inguinal hernia with no adenopathy. He did have an X-ray of the right elbow, which showed no osseous or articular abnormality. There was minimal soft tissue swelling over the olecranon, no effusion. He also had a follow-up MRI of the elbow without contrast that showed chronic appearing mild to moderate common extensor tendinopathy. Common flexor tendon was intact. There was mild to moderate biceps insertional tendinopathy, mild brachialis insertional tendinopathy. Triceps tendon was intact. No macroscopic cartilage defect was seen and no effusion. He underwent an EMG and nerve conduction study, which demonstrated no evidence of cervical radiculopathy, brachial plexopathy, or peripheral nerve entrapment. And he underwent a skin biopsy, which did not show any evidence of small fiber neuropathy. As far as his labs, he had an unremarkable CBC. His white count was 7, hemoglobin of 14. His MCV was 86 and a platelet count of 182. On his CMP, he had normal electrolytes. His creatinine was 0.9, normal glucose, normal protein. His albumin was 4.9. He had normal ALT, AST. His ALKphos was normal at 59. His T-bili was 1.3. He had a normal anion gap. He also had a normal hemoglobin A1C. He had a urinalysis and a urine culture, which were unremarkable. He had a CRP, which was 0.7, the reference range being less than 5, and an ESR that was 2, with the reference range being less than 10. And he had a CK that was 44. He had an ANA that was 40, with the reference range upper limit of normal being 40, with a speckled pattern. He was anti-Smith negative, anti-double-stranded DNA negative, proteinase 3 antibody negative, myeloperoxidase negative, TPO antibody negative, CCP IgG negative, RNP antibody negative, RF negative, ANCA titer was negative, his SSA and SSB antibodies were negative, he had a negative anti-cardiolipin antibody, and he did have an HLA-B27 that was negative. He also had a cytokine panel, which had, a bunch of interleukins, TNF that were all normal. He had a Lyme antibody screen that was negative. He also had a negative HIV and a negative RPR. He had an SPEP, which was normal. They checked some of his vitamins. His vitamin B1, B6, and B12 levels were normal. He had normal ceruloplasmin and serum copper level. He had a normal blood mercury level and a normal negative myelin-associated glycoprotein. Just in terms of his course, he was treated with an empiric course of oral steroids and an NSAID, nebumetone, with little response after 2 weeks, reporting that his pain is mostly improved with physical therapy, not with any of the pharmacological therapy. And his rheumatologist is considering adding on a biologic agent next. So I'll stop there.
Okay. Yeah, this is a lot of good data. And this is a challenging situation to be in. And so I guess I'll just go through my thoughts starting from the labs. So I think a lot of things that are good to know here in the labs is that the basic labs are unremarkable, right? So far what I've been discussing is mostly the common causes. If we were to look at much more rare causes, we would look at if there's small, subtle hints in basic labs like the CBC, the CMP, things like ALKphos, things like CK, maybe LDH, to see like, is there anything very abnormal that would make us concerned? And we're not seeing any of that. So in this situation, by far, like maybe 100 times more common than a rare cause would be a common cause that we're not able to figure out yet because it's in the transition of being mild to moderate. And then looking at kind of the other things that, as you noticed, like I didn't ask for inflammatory markers, but that is something that we usually get. The reason I didn't ask for inflammatory markers is because I have such a strong suspicion in this patient, even before I even get the labs and imaging, that they have a seronegative spondyloarthropathy, that I expect them to be normal. If they are abnormal, it still wouldn't raise concern that it's not a seronegative spondyloarthropathy unless the levels are very high. And what do I mean by very high? This is, again, there's not a specific cutoff, but if, for example, the ESR was 100, now that would be something that would make me more concerned about something like gout or something like something atypical that we're dealing with that's not a common thing. Right? But because even the, all the labs that we're getting here, your analysis, ANA are checked, and RF, CCP, and they're all normal, that even strengthens that this is not something like a rheumatoid arthritis, not something like lupus, but it is in the seronegative spondyloarthropathy category. Now, I think one of the challenges here is what to make again of the symptoms that he's having with his GU symptoms, right? He has issues with pain in that area. He has dysuria. He has this issue with contraction of the sphincter, midway. So is this somehow tied to the disease that we're dealing with, or are we dealing with two separate things, right? So I think it's important to clarify that. I think one good thing that we noticed is that he's gotten infectious testing probably several times for UTIs, prostatitis. That's not what we're dealing with, right? It'll also be very unlikely to have prostatitis or UTI, something like that, for 3 years, for multiple years. So I think that the likelihood of that is just very low. So what we're dealing with here, it's seeming more and more likely that the symptoms in the urinary area are secondary symptoms, either to something in the back, but we're not catching it on MRI, or something in the actual musculature there. So how could we tie musculature there with a question of could this be seronegative spondyloarthropathy? Well, one of the things that you can get with these seronegative spondyloarthropathy is sacroiliitis. And it can be hard sometimes for people to tease apart what that is, because it feels a little bit different in each patient. In many patients, it does feel like back pain or hip pain. And when it occurs like that, it's easier to diagnose it. However, I have also seen some patients complain of burning sensation in that area or complain of butt pain or only butt pain when they're sitting. Right. And usually, when we think of those things, first of all, not many things come to mind because it's not a very common complaint, but we don't necessarily think of sacroiliac joint. But the sacroiliac joint is actually something that will flare or will get worse in that area in the butt. And we can also understand that if you have sacroiliitis, you may not present with actually the sacroiliac inflammation from a complaint perspective, but it may be secondary gluteal tendinopathy, for example, that you get. So I'm almost wondering, like, could he have pelvic floor muscle dysfunction in that area from the inflammation of the tendons around the sacroiliac joint? So that's one thing that I'll be curious about. Another thing that we'll look at is the MRI of the elbow. So the good thing is we have a lot of X-rays, and it's not showing something called erosions. So what we look at for inflammatory arthritis that's chronic, like been going on for 3 years, is there erosions? Erosions mean that we have severe enough inflammation that there's scar damage to the bones. We're not seeing that, which again supports our theory that this is not a primary arthritis in the joint itself, but it's a periarthritis around it. And that is supported even further by the MRI, right? The MRI is showing that we have tendinopathy, not only tendinopathy, but in the biceps, we're showing insertional site tendinopathy. Biceps insertional tendinopathy is not very common. In a young patient, if there was nothing else going on, we would be asking, like, is he just working out doing biceps curls way too much? Right. But if he's not doing that, that really points towards an enthesitis, which again further increases our concern for could this be a seronegative spondyloarthropathy? So I think the MRI perfectly is compatible with that as well. We're looking at the other symptoms. We thought about could this be neurologic? The EMG is normal. The MRI pelvis isn't showing much, just maybe some reactive things there. There is, however, there's one entity in that area that can also be neurologic that we haven't necessarily seen and may not be caught on the EMG, and that is a plexopathy there. But the issue with that is that it's usually much more painful severe, and constant. After it's resolved, it may be not as painful anymore. But although I'm not a neurologist, I've never seen a plexopathy not present with severe pain enough to go to the ER. So unless it's a chronic plexopathy, I'm thinking that it's probably also less likely to go further down in the neurological workup. And right now, I'm going to focus almost all my energy in this periarthritis workup. Now, what do you do with an HLA-B27 that's negative? When you get an HLA-B27, one thing it helps us do is support our theory that this is a seronegative spondyloarthropathy. But what a lot of people may not realize is that a lot of patients with seronegative spondyloarthropathy may not have a positive HLA-B27. So while it's a good confirmatory test, right? Like let's say he has the entire picture and we have an HLA-B27 positive, that would be helpful in confirming the diagnosis. A negative test doesn't rule it out. We use the joint complaints to look at what type of joint problem we're dealing with, which in this case is a periarthritis and specifically hints of enthesitis. And that really puts us towards seronegative spondyloarthropathy there. Now, out of the seronegative spondyloarthropathies, there are several different types again. One is psoriatic arthritis, one is ankylosing spondylitis, one is IBD, and one is reactive arthritis. What are the important questions that are necessary to tease these apart and to change management? So, one is we have no inflammation of the eyes. So, that's really important because if there's inflammation of the eyes, suddenly nothing else in the body is really that important. The eyes are the only thing we need to focus on, right? Because if there's inflammation there, we're worried about saving vision. So, that's really good. The second question then is there GI involvement? And why is it important to know if there's GI involvement? It's because that we're considering whether this patient needs immunosuppressive therapy, right? If we're starting things like NSAIDs, if we're starting things like biologics, there are certain biologics that will increase the risk of GI disease, especially if the patient already has inflammatory bowel disease. So that's one thing to really ask about is, are we sure that none of these symptoms are actually GI in nature? Right, we confirm he has no diarrhea. We confirm he doesn't have the abdominal pain, things like malabsorption that would make us concerned for Crohn's disease. Okay. And then after that, in terms of the involvement of the joints, the number one most important question is there axial involvement? What axial means is the center, the spine, or the sacroiliac joints are involved. And the reason is because when this is involved, first of all, it's a lot more difficult to control. And as you can imagine, let's say if you have a patient who has pain in their elbow, they're still able to function most of the time. But if you really have inflammation in the back and scarring there, lots of things are important in the back, the nerves, of course, the joints and the muscles there. And even we're seeing sometimes GU complications. This requires a higher level of treatment and also responds less towards things like methotrexate. So what I would be doing here is I would be getting an X-ray at least, or if not an MRI, for the SI joints to look if there's sacroiliitis or not. And once we know those things, we can determine whether he needs what type of treatment he needs and which biologic, if we were to start a biologic, would be reasonable at that point.
Wow, Jeffrey, that was just phenomenal. Thank you so much for all of your insights. This is just, an amazing discussion. I will tell you, he has not had diarrhea, no weight loss, no symptoms to suggest like a Crohn's or, IBD picture. He hasn't yet undergone MRI of the SI joint, so I don't have that piece of data for you yet. I do have one final lab result that I want to know what your opinion is of. So he had a ganglioside GD1A IgG antibody, which was highly positive with a titer of 1 to 800, normal being less than 1 to 100, IgM negative. And from my reading, that has been associated with Guillain-Barré syndrome. So I'm wondering if you think that this is a red herring, or is this something that is important to it? Is that, do you ever, even though they're considered seronegative spondyloarthropathies, are any of these kind of cross-reacting antibodies ever at play?
That's a good question and very interesting finding. I will say that although I'm not a neurologist, I can share some of my thoughts as a rheumatologist of what I would be doing in a rheumatology clinic if I saw that antibody come back positive in the workup. So as you said that typically what we think of with anti-ganglioside antibodies is something like Guillain-Barré, And typically, Guillain-Barré, the history that we have is a ascending paralysis. So again, this would not already be the typical story for that. Now, a thing that some of us may not be as familiar with is that there's actually variants of Guillain-Barré, and these can cause different types of symptoms. So, like one variant, for example, is something called Miller-Fisher, which instead of going from down to up, kind of goes from top to bottom. And there are other kind of rare variants of Guillain-Barré. Some of them are purely motor. Some of them are purely sensory, right? So the question I think I would have here is that, is this consistent with the neurological exam that we're seeing in this patient? And if we look at the neurological exam, we're seeing that there's no more reflexes. There's not really evidence of motor weakness. There's no really any evidence of even like sensory weakness in the kind of peripheral areas. So for this to be Guillain-Barré, I would think that maybe what would make sense is if you had lumbosacral involvement re with radiculopathy there, just like kind of in that area. And maybe that could explain some of the GU symptoms that we're dealing with. But does it explain the enthesitis that or and arthritis that we're dealing with? I would say it'd be very unlikely because, again, we're having issues with the elbow, with the biceps. These are really focal areas. Even if you had a neurological issue there, you wouldn't have insertional site tendinopathy there. It'd be very unlikely. And it's so multifocal and asymmetric, it makes it a lot less likely, I would think, for this to be a primary neurological process, right? And in rheumatology, sometimes we deal with neurological processes that do involve scattered nerves. And what the thing that we call that is motoneuritis multiplex. However, I would say that motoneuritis multiplex really is not a primary consideration in this case because we have a normal nerve conduction study. And furthermore, in my experience, usually people with that who have infarcted their nerves, they don't actually tend to resolve. So you have neurological evidence of the deficits of neuropathy, and often, unfortunately, you have severe debilitating pain that you can't really deal with. You can't really treat or cure it besides using pain medication. So I think that like a primary neurological process in here would be a lot less likely. I'd be curious to see what neurology says, but I think that this is still almost all completely consistent with the seronegative spondyloarthropathy. And I'm curious to see if they're going to do an MRI of the sacroiliac joints, and hopefully that he does well with the treatment that they give him.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeffrey. This has been a wonderful discussion. I don't know if we have quite a final diagnosis because it's still a work in progress, but my thought, and I want to get your opinion on this, could this be a post-COVID-19 related seronegative inflammatory arthritis? Or is the COVID-19 also just sort of coincident, true, unrelated?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think with the history that we're getting here, it really does suggest that it's a post-COVID-19 reactive arthritis. I think the one thing that we'll have to just it will just take time to see is sometimes, and when I look at, back into the cases that I've seen, sometimes what you have is you actually have a patient who's already going to have psoriatic arthritis or who's going to already have ankylosing spondylitis, and then the COVID-19, it triggers their immune system and it actually brings it out early. So that's why it's really important to follow this longitudinally. But with this history that we're getting here, it fits really well with a post COVID-19 reactive arthritis.
Wow. And how would you treat this differently than, I guess, your garden variety seronegative spondyloarthritis?
So that's a really good question as well. And I think the important thing from my experience to know is that usually a post-infectious reactive arthritis is less likely to be chronic and easier to treat overall than a primary ankylosing spondylitis or IBD. So what I would hope here is that if he would need escalation of treatment, he may only need it for a couple of years before we can actually wean. In patients that actually have psoriatic arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, the current guidelines say that you need to be on this for lifelong because we want to prevent progression. But I think the fact that this could be reactive arthritis makes me lean towards treatment that is proportional to the dysfunction and consideration of weaning once there's resolution of inflammation.
Wow, phenomenal. Thank you so much, Jeffrey. This has been just an amazing discussion, such a treat. And you are just a brilliant diagnostician. The way that you parse this case, I am just floored.
Thanks so much. I'm really flattered. I'm not sure if I did anything much. It looks like that, I agree. I think that everyone already did the right thing and they were very thorough and comprehensive. So I'm glad that he got such great care and I hope the best for him. Thank you so much for bringing this case.
Yes, and thanks everyone.
All right. Have a happy holidays.
Happy
See
holidays,
you.
everyone.
That's a wrap, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to be part of our community, join us for our live virtual morning report, where you can present the case or discuss with us. Visit our website for details. We would love to have you.